This is Life Worlds, the place where we explore life through other eyes and minds. Let's flip the script and discover how to orient your world around nature. I'm Alexa Permanish. Come join me as we get down and forage for fungi, stalk coyotes, draft laws for rivers, hum with beehives, sing bird language, and help beavers to dam again. Let these stories spark your reconnection to nature's multiverse. Learn how to bring ecosystems back to life, become an agent for other intelligences, and begin to see how you too are the sum of all life worlds. Hello, hello. Soul Fire Sessions have come to Life Worlds. These occasional special episodes are going to be our take on the good old concept of a fireside chat. Intimate, philosophical, challenging, sometimes zany, hopefully always insightful. These are discussions with visionaries who don't often get the airtime to speak about their deeper ways of being and feeling. And, as you may have guessed, what lights their souls on fire. In this first session, I speak with my dear friend, Daniel Schmachtenberger, a social philosopher and founding director of the Civilization Research Institute. Daniel has a particular interest in the sunny topics of catastrophic and existential risk, artificial intelligence, civilization and institutional decay and collapse, as well as progress, collective action problems, social organization theories, and the relevant domains in philosophy and science. With the fire roaring, we delve into the psychological and metaphysical underpinnings of the metacrisis, traversing topics such as fragmented consciousness, Taoism, wholeness, feeling in service to thinking, Dharma inquiries, conflict theory, and what it might mean to live a meaningful life. Welcome to what I think I'm going to call Soul Fire Sessions. So a little twist on the regular fireside sessions. Daniel, you have been an inspiration to me and so many people for your work in the world. You have such a piercing way of expressing the metacrisis, issues of existential risk, AI, technology, civilizational design, failures. Myself and many people have turned to your work to try and contextualize where we're at as a human species and civilization and where we can go from here. And I can say that you are one of the people, Daniel, who has absolutely changed the way I see the world and feel the world. But today, I want to dive into something that's a little bit different to what I usually do on the show and maybe even what you usually talk about in all of your work and speaking. Because I think right from the start of our friendship, there was something that binded us together that was deeper than our analysis of the world and that kind of goes to the core of what I feel we're both in devotion and service to, what actually fundamentally matters to us and why we do everything that we do. So this is an invitation for a conversation that we can just explore the spirituality, the philosophy, the heart, the core that is animating both of our souls, hence the fire in the background for people who are watching. And I think that this is a very, very critical part of the work that doesn't get spoken about enough and that actually allows us to keep doing what we do. So we talk about this a lot, you and I, behind the scenes, and I feel it would be a real, I don't know, joy to share this conversation with others. How does that sound to you?
Sounds wonderful.
All right. So let's dive right in. The reason that this podcast is called Life Worlds, and one of the things I'm trying to do with this show is to speak about duality, right? This othering, this separation that occurs all across our society, all across our psychology. This is a human mind that doesn't see the whole. And what has struck me from our conversations is you say something very similar, that the underlying cause of so many of the problems around us come from humans not operating from wholeness, operating from a fragmented consciousness. What does that mean? What is a fragmented soul, a fragmented consciousness?
I think I heard that term in particular as a description of the underlying basis of the unnecessary human-induced suffering from David Bohm when he was talking about a challenge in the nature of our way of seeing the world as underlying our way of making sense of the world and what's worth doing and the behaviors. You know, his book, Wholeness and the Implicate Order, it was the lack of sensing the implicate order that interconnected and gave rise to all things, from which nothing can be separated, from which nothing can, giving that, nothing can be benefited at the expense of something else for real. And it was so interesting to see him in dialogue with Krishnamurti on that, where Krishnamurti was really, though people would think of him as a spiritual teacher, which you can, he was really talking very deeply about the underlying basis of human conflict that leads to human violence and all the forms of sublimated violence, and what would it take to actually remove the basis of how conflict expresses adequately, that violence isn't the only answer, particularly in a post-nuclear world where violence can't be expressed the way that it has been historically. And when I thought about it more, we see environmental harms come from trying to do something that we care about, where we're building something to benefit one purpose, but it happens to affect other things. The other things that it affects are outside of what we're measuring and optimizing for. So you get all these environmental externalities. That's a fragmentation of metrics, right? I separated reality into the metric I'm optimizing for here before it turns into GDP is timber so we can build houses, which we all care about, or Scotch Guard is really nice on your jacket so it doesn't get wet, but then you have PFAS covering every surface area of water in the world. So being able to think about benefiting one purpose without thinking about how that's connected to every other aspect of reality is one example of the fragmentation. Obviously, conflict theory from the point of view of agents benefit self at the expense of other, or in-group at the expense of out-group at the level of nation states or religions or political parties or whatever is another example. Benefit the near term at the expense of the long term. They're all ways of separating reality into I, we, it. It doesn't include everything else that it depends upon, and then seeking to advance goals for that set that have effects outside of that set, but that are affecting a reality that what we care about on the inside of the set depends upon. And so if one is seeing the interconnectedness of everything deeply enough, lots of strategies that seem to make sense, if they don't make sense anymore.
That's very well said. One of the examples is in the rush to electrify or decarbonize, we might end up gouging out the very last remnants of biodiverse life on the planet. Something that I struggle with, Daniel, a question I hold, it's twofold. The first is, you know, those talks of Krishnamurti and Bohm that you actually first turned me on to, and then I listen to most of them and I find them absolutely captivating. Krishnamurti seems to say that any action of thinking inherently divides. As someone who is attempting her own spiritual journey of seeing the whole as much as I can, and yet someone who has a super sharp mind that tries to move at 100 miles per hour, and I'm often just like wishing that I could turn the damn thing off. If any act of thought divides, then we still need to like operate in the world. We can't just be like super blissed out on a cushion, like feeling the oneness. So how do we move between A, how can I begin to sense the whole? And then B, when I start to act, how do I not lose that connection to that? And then a related question that I get asked quite often is like, is it just inherent in human beings that we particularize? Right? Is it inherent that we fragment at a certain point in time? Is this unique to human consciousness?
Yeah, so much that is in the framing of that question is what I recognize in our first conversation, Why I Love You, is that you were working and have always worked very hard to understand things precisely. And there's a very strong impulse in you to intellectual integrity and rigor. But it doesn't come from like being a stickler of getting things right. It comes from wanting to understand reality clearly enough to know how to relate meaningfully, effectively, how to be in service of the whole. So the head in service of something that isn't arising from the head, right? There's a heart impulse. I remember at the same time watching you have like passionate kind of angry expression about how can people not understand the importance of non-human life.
Yeah. You share that as well, for sure.
Yeah. But the intellectual pursuit was coming from a place that wasn't grounded in intellect or words at all. So long as that which divides but is powerful, that allows us to build technologies and laws and projects, is in service to something that is felt that can error correct where it's missing and that is ultimately orienting it. That's what Miguel Kress means by the master and emissary. You have both of these, but the relationship between them matters. Because you were saying feeling a certain kind of bliss, but earlier you were saying seeing the whole. You can't see the whole because the act of perception is inherently reduction. Even before you get to naming it, the elephant parable where you know, if I'm touching this part of the elephant or this part, it looks different, but that was intrinsic to the nature of the perceptual process. If I'm looking at the house from the west side or the east side or the inside or a telescopic view or a microscopic view on part of the wood, it looks different. And they're all partially true. And so the act of perception is inherently a reduction of the total complexity of reality. So one can never be outside of reality to see it all. And so there's a humility that comes in knowing that you can't see it all. You want to try to better, but you can't. And that every perspective you take gives you some non-zero value. So you need to be able to try to see it, not as a whole, but from lots and lots of perspectives. And then integrate those, but that's not a picture anymore. And yet, there is something about the nature of feeling as a distinct sense from seeing, and also as distinct from the cognitive process of thinking, that has a more integrative nature intrinsically. We can get into that if you want. The difference between thinking and seeing and feeling as far as parts and integration goes.
I want to get into how you learn to feel and how you continue to do it, especially these days. Now with CRI, your Civilization Research Institute, you're working on, for those who don't know the organization, a lot of the world's most deep existential risks. Work that can seem very technical, political. How did you learn to feel and how do you continue doing it when throughout the day you're on hundreds of Zoom calls and you're having to create strategies and go to war rooms? Is there a tension in that?
I think we do as humans learn how to feel, meaning I don't think every aspect of feeling is innate and doesn't require development. But I think more often we learn how not to feel. I think the aspects that are innate get numbed and deadened. And having the advantage of being homeschooled as a kid, there were certain aspects of feeling my own interest in things. I was allowed to study my interests as opposed to have to turn off what my interest was to focus on the thing I'm supposed to focus on. I didn't have a lot of people, kids that I interacted with, but I had a lot of animals I interacted with. And I felt like I could understand them and felt a lot of mutual understanding with them. And then I think my own painful experiences that I had definitely sensitized me to painful experiences other people have and that other beings have. And I kind of got into activism after accidentally coming across a factory farm. And as someone who loved animals growing up and then seeing the condition of these animals, I could never be the same after that. And again, fortunate because of homeschool, I got to dive into spending a lot of time with animal rights groups. Like I was kind of initiated into the human-induced horror to the world, to the natural world young. And what happened for me at that time, and I think in a similar situation, lots of people might have had a similar experience, was that was the beginning of kind of suicidal existential angst for me. Because I couldn't imagine all of those beings being tortured and being able to forget about it and just be happy. I couldn't imagine like being able to focus on my life and be stoked while that's happening and to really tune into it. It was insanity causing. And I didn't want to be complicit with my species. And for people who haven't seen what the inside of a factory farm is really like, you might not know what I'm talking about, but you can go explore that on your own. But then I realized if I kill myself, all the animals are still there. So I can't kill myself because that's a totally unethical thing. But I also can't live knowing that's there and just like be stoked. I'm like, okay, I could have just as easily, this consciousness could have just as easily been that animal born in the factory farm. Or could have just as easily been that kid born into a situation where he'll become a child soldier. And like, I'm luckier to not be in that position. And maybe not being in that position, I can do something for them. And so I started setting all of the animal rights work and environmental work and everything I could to be like, who's solving this? How do we solve this? And that both helped me to know what people were doing. And then same as you, the intellectual integrity had me get into like, but wait, this isn't working. Like the core metrics on species extinction are getting worse as all these groups are working on it. The core metrics on biodiversity loss and ecological destruction. And then it became clear that we didn't just need more of the activism that was happening, but something totally different in kind, which led, again, an intellectual process that was all in service to a grounded feeling process. But, you know, you asked the question about like the political experiences and strategic stuff and the grounding of it. Yeah, I am fortunate to be in the position where I get to talk and work with people in institutional settings that can make real choices and changes to things in the world. And those are serious settings. The feeling of what we're there for, the sense of the sacred is not usually part of those rooms. But, you know, I cry looking at what is happening most days, not every day, but most days. Because when I hear a stat about how many people died at the Ukraine-Russia border, it's not just a stat. Most of them didn't die instantly. Even if it was a combatant as opposed to a civilian, that means like a 19 or 20-year-old boy whose mom will never see him again. I see it. I feel it. And if I don't cry, then I'm left with it. Usually something like anger at the people who make those choices. And that would not serve what is sacred well or leave me, you know, in a good position for it. So I find that feeling that which you're working to serve deeply, continuously is more important than thinking about it well. And it grounds the thinking about it. It makes sure that why you're doing it is rightly aligned. And your sense making can't be better than your sensing. You have to sense first to then be able to make sense of those things. And some people jump to sense making too fast because you get dopamine hits on finding patterns and being able to say smart sounding things. But the depth of the sensing is what grounds it.
You use this word, sacred. What is sacred to you?
It's early for this time in spring, but this tree right outside is just completely going off of these white flowers right now. It looks so beautiful. I wish I could turn the camera around. Life is sacred to me. Reality is sacred, I think. You know, I'm not a big fan of trying to define sacred. If the definition excluded anything, it would probably be problematic. But the interconnected everything that Bohm was talking about, what is the implicate order that is underneath and giving rise to the explicate order of all that we see and apprehend? And it expresses through every being, right? Through every life form. That question in theology that was always debated, is God transcendent beyond the creation or immanent indwelling within? But the indwelling within side is the thing that, when we're clear on it, makes us safe stewards of power, because you can't violate the creation without violating the creator. It is a sin to the sacred to do that. Whereas if I think about God as transcendent, then maybe I can destroy stuff here because God will sort it out in heaven, or reincarnation or moksha or whatever the only transcendent concept is.
There's something there about expanding our circle of care. So you experienced the factory farm that led you to feel about these beings, these species. And I find that can we expand our circle of care until it includes absolutely everything? Because as you said, there is nothing that is left out of it. And that includes ourselves. And I think that many people find it easy to love things in the world and not to love themselves. But there is a very interesting question that comes up for me in this that I wasn't going to ask today, but it's very present. If we expand that sacredness to everything, it must also hold the things that we don't want to see happening, such as the wars or the extinctions or the bombs or the opponents. So how does one reconcile, you know, it's easy to look at the tree or the fire and feel the sacredness, but when you look at the thing that you find so abhorrent and immoral, how does one hold, should one hold, can one hold the sacredness of that too? Because otherwise we're just particularizing again.
There is a distinction worth making. To be able to see everything that is happening as obviously a part of reality and to love reality still. Yes. Okay, so first, the concept of expand my circle of care. It's like partly a valid concept and partly there's this interesting modern distortion in it where we shrunk our circle of care in unnatural ways to the place that we take that as a given that it then needs expanded. Like, you know, I think ever since agriculture, we've done this heavily, and ever since touchscreens that rearrange the entire universe for my preferences, especially. But when I'm in wilderness, my experience, and this was a fascinating thing for me the first time I noticed it, is that after just a little while there, my system resets and I can feel a different complete peace with death, even including all the things that are undone for me to do, that is different than what I feel in a house box. Because in the forest, I can't see one square foot that doesn't have death in it. There's rotting leaves, there's a decaying tree everywhere, and it's all fucking beautiful, and there's life growing out of it. And the distinction between the tree and the mushroom and it's all blurry. There isn't the sense of so much individuality and separateness. But the market, let's say there are parts of me. Let's say there's more spiritual higher self parts and more egoic parts. The market appeals to the egoic parts of me, right? And figures out how to point out some pain point where I don't have something somebody else has or that could make my personal life better, and then sells me that shit. And whatever parts of yourself you feed all the time, that will be more prevalent in your awareness. And so there's this racket. I can see the religions of the world largely compensating for taking people out of their evolutionary environment and putting them in a world that they're not evolutionarily fit to, and then trying to fix the fact that they're not fit to the world that they're in. And I'm not romanticizing that everyone who grew up in indigenous culture had bodhisattva care for all beings. There is work that has to happen with feeling. Like, there is training in feeling, but mostly there's also a lot that is innate that we actually train out or condition out. And so I think we've talked about this before, but I don't know which one it was, and I don't even know if it's a true story, but I like the story that there's some Native American tribe that whenever the kids point at things and say, what is that? What is that? What is that? Like kids in every culture do, that the answer they get goes something like, that's the great spirit expressed as a mountain, as opposed to that's a mountain. That's the great spirit expressed as a crow. It's a great spirit expressed as a buffalo. So the first time they hear about a thing, they don't hear about the particular part. They hear about the implicate order at the basis of all, and then the expression in that unique form. You can imagine that when a kid was learning the parts of universe, they heard them as an expression of that which is deeper than parts first, the ontology that they got would be really different. And what does circle of care mean when everything is an expression of this interconnected thing? And when Ubuntu, I am because we are, like I wouldn't be without we. Do I have to expand my circle of care from I to we if I am because we are? Meaning I wouldn't exist without all these people. I would be dead on the savannah in a second. And like the fact that evolution did not select for individual sapiens is so important, right? Individual sapiens died in every environment. Evolution selected for groups of sapiens. And so this was a critique that was made of Maslow's hierarchy where safety was below belonging. It's like, no, but without belonging, there was no safety in any evolutionary environment for any human ever. So if you even just think about the connectivity of some people with other people, deep attachment with a tribe level of people, and with some other kind of natural environment, you don't feel as isolated to begin with, which also means as nihilistic and as narcissistic, in which case expand the circle of care is a different thing, right? Like, I think we are conditioning nihilistic, narcissistic, and then trying to give people a spiritual goal that they should have a wide circle of care while they have been conditioned for the opposite thing. And so I wanted to kind of speak to that part first.
how do we train that innate way of seeing back into people? Humanity, we've lost our sense of the sacred profoundly. I think even many people who are working so deeply on trying to make things better, either there's no place to talk about the sacred, they're completely alone, they feel like they can't bring what's sacred into their workplace, they can't bring it into their scholastic environment. It's taboo, it's shameful to talk about it. So we've profoundly lost the sense of the sacred. And actually, this reminds me, I pulled up this quote from the Bohm and Krishnamurti conversation. And I can't remember which, I think it was Bohm who said this to Krishnamurti, and I'm going to say it to you. He said, "Can we inquire together into what is sacred? How would you and I explore this? If you had the passion and the sense of something infinite, immensely sacred, how would you tell me about it and convey that flame inside of you? Could you even communicate it to me? Could you communicate it so profoundly that it captures me? Could you, by your very presence, transform my consciousness?" How do we get it back? It's innate. It got trained out of us. How the hell do we get it back?
There's something really beautiful in that quote where it was asking a relational question, which is different than just asking the question, how do I deepen my own sense of what is sacred? It's saying, how can you invoke it in me? Which again comes back to this human, we were a social primate where group selection was the key feature. In deep resonance with someone, is there a mirror neuron effect where you can start to feel what they feel and start to see what they see beyond the specifics of their words more than you could on your own? Totally. Like if you hang out with a friend who's a photographer and you're not a photographer, every little piece of grass coming through a crack in the sidewalk is the most amazing picture that is a testament to nature's tenacity and whatever. And they're like focusing on it.
This is me. I'm like, look.
Then pretty soon after they do that 30 times and there was like some rusty bike that looked like trash to you and they saw this amazing thing, and then their eyes can infect you, right? Like that method of perceiving, and you're like, oh, wow. And then you're sensitized to that thing in a way you weren't before. And I think as social primates, being able to see something that someone else saw as valuable had evolutionary value. So our ability to be like, oh, someone is perceiving something that has value into the nature of the perception, maybe it's something important I should be able to see too. So this comes to that, like you're the average of the five people you spend the most time around kind of thing. And this is why the ashram or the monastery or the sangha are important phenomena, is if you spend time with people, like you go on a nature walk with someone who is just in awe at nature and like both gets just moved into silent reverie and then is like spitting with excitement at this mushroom they found, that has an infectious quality. And the nature of the questions they ask, how did this happen? So that's how I want kids to learn, right? Is getting to go on those nature walks, getting to facilitate their interests and questions. And I don't find that you have to invoke passion and interest in kids. I find that you kill it. And if you don't kill it and you just actually be with them in the questions they're interested in, they are naturally passionate about things. And unless they've already been so damaged, but like, if you don't facilitate the things they're interested in, and then you force them to focus on shit they're not interested in, you break people's interest in life, and then they just want addictive hits to fill the emptiness. And their interest in life is also an expression of some sense of sacred, that there's anything worth being interested in at all, stand and know more about at all.
I'm remembering a few months ago, we were taking a walk in the forest, and I was like, we have to talk about the end of the world and artificial intelligence. And you were like, stop, look at this moss, look at this tree bark. You were that person. I was getting so frustrated. I was like, Daniel, like the bots are coming for us. What are we going to do? And you were like, no. I want to look at this tree bark. And I remember like in that moment being like, shit, yeah, no.
Looking at the tree bark and the moss is the only reason I care about the other things. And it's also where I learn like, how do things live in more symbiosis? And how do complex systems self-organize without central government? It's the source of the care and the learning.
You stopped me in my tracks early in our friendship. I was talking about beauty or something, and I was quite insecure to talk about beauty in front of all these, you know, big adults with all these big ideas. And you just looked at me, you're like, if it wasn't beautiful, I wouldn't care, right? There's this like profound orientation towards it is inherently beautiful, and that is why it all freaking matters.
I think I wrote you something on a birthday card about that once.
Yes, you did write that to me on a birthday card.
I remember the first time I kind of realized it, because I was so into studying all the sciences as a kid. And again, one of the benefits of not going to school was I didn't know to separate things by subject. It just built into, you have an hour for this and an hour for this. It seems kind of obvious, but I didn't have that. So I would ask a question. And like, you know, if a kid asks why the sky is blue, you have to get into how light diffraction works and how nitrogen atmospheres work and how molecular bonding for N2 works. And you have to get into how the retina works and how the subjective experience of blueness relates to that and what's happening in the optical cortex. And then the theory of mind of, is blue the same thing for all of us? So it's celestial physics, it's chemistry, it's neuroscience, it's all these things. There are no separate subjects. There's just, if you're with the question, it's all connected. So I was so into studying all the sciences, but it was a sacred impulse. It was like, I want to understand this reality I'm in better. And I was so into every type of activism, because even though I was still really wrestling with what the ultimate meaning is, I could feel it, right? My mind was trying to understand it more, but I could feel it. And it was clear that every time a sentient being was suffering and didn't need to be and support could be offered, it was meaningful. So it felt like true and good were such a focus. And I didn't have a lot of time for art in my life. And everyone who was an artist, I just loved them. I was just so impressed with them. And in terms of the Greek, the true, the good, and the beautiful kind of triple, I remember the point at which I realized it's actually only because it's all beautiful that good or true matter at all. If it wasn't beautiful, like, I wouldn't even care to understand it. I wouldn't care to serve it. Like, if there wasn't inherent beauty in it, which is the foundation of the meaning. And so beautiful is more fundamental, and the good and true are in service to it.
And knowledge is a form of beauty. I don't think many people know that you have like a whole body of text that many people haven't read about philosophy and beauty. But in one of them, you wrote, you can understand all about the sun and the atmosphere and the rotation of the earth, and you can still miss the radiance of the sunset. There is no substitute for direct perception. And then you wrote about plants, and it's a lot slightly longer quote, but you know, in studying the biology of the plant, I can deaden myself to the real plant. I can know its Latin name, its genetics, its evolutionary environment. But in doing so, I have less intention on the utter uniqueness of this life in front of me. This infinity about it, I will never know. And as such, I'll miss the opportunity to really see it. And so as I consider all of that complexity and the integrity and the beauty and the order and the wildness and the intelligence, and remember that even that isn't a measurable fraction of what is going on, but then I can use that knowledge to prime an even deeper wonder and respect and reverence and awe, then the practice of knowledge and the practice of the Tao are dancing. This feels fundamentally pure in my body. It's what you were saying before. It's the wonder and the awe of the beauty. Then the knowledge is in service of that, but the knowledge acquisition, the strategy is grounded in this much deeper, unknowable sensation. So for people who've never heard the concept of this before, can you share what is the dance of the Tao, the 10,000 things? What is that?
Yeah. So you're reading from this blog post from a number of years ago that I called the Dance of the Tao and the 10,000 things.
You're reaching for a book.
In this little book. It begins saying the Tao that is nameable is not the eternal Tao, and the knowledge that's knowable is not the eternal knowledge. But the naming and the knowing give rise to the 10,000 things, and the 10,000 things can obscure your clarity about the Tao. And of course, a book of words about the nature of reality starts with the word saying, "It's not. I can't put it in the book." You just can't do that. But then it doesn't stop. The book doesn't just stop there and then say, don't even try, right? And you have the rest of the book that is hoping to be able to point at something that you can get a sense of, that you get a gestalt of beyond the words. So there is this sense, and there's a lot of people who practice spirituality in a way where the intellect is just in the way. It's just a thing to get over. It's an agitation of the mental field or whatever. And you asked this question earlier about everything being a part of reality, being sacred. that was so clear to me since I was young, especially because I was raised with Eastern traditions, where a lot of the ways people interpreted the Vedantic Eastern traditions in particular was like the mind and intellect are problems. It's not that those were all the interpretations of the Eastern, but that is a common one. And it was so clear that like I had this just innate sensing that whatever meaning is grounds itself in the way the universe works, and the universe is an expression of it. And evolution did not evolve those capacities for them to just be completely in the way. And I found that I could study the biology of the plant and just be like, oh, this is an oak tree and it's like this, and go right into the knowing and sense less. And that was a totally lame thing to do. But I could, as I got deeper into understanding that every cell in that tree does a trillion metabolic functions a second that is actually uncomputable. And as I really got into understanding that the coral reefs thousands of miles away, this tree is supporting by the way it stabilizes the watershed and the chemistry that flows into the rivers there. And then it, rather than be like, oh, I understand it, there's like this Dunning-Kruger thing where you understand a little bit and you're confident, and then you understand more and you're like, shit, I could never possibly understand this thing. And so with the more understanding, there's also this profound kind of humility that can prime the sense of the Tao more. Like, because now I'm sensing into a trillion metabolic functions a second per cell. And before it, with that thought, I might not have even sensed into it, and it creates an even vaster awe. And so that was what I meant by the dance of the Tao and the 10,000 things. The feeling of the unknowable, unexpressible can give us a degree of care and passion that makes us want to study and learn more. But the study and learning can also prime us to the unknowable. And that relationship I love. In that way, I feel that not only can intellect be a useful tool to solve problems in the world, it can also be a beautiful aspect of a spiritual experience.
The trouble here is something that I referred to earlier in the conversation, and I'm speaking from my direct experience. You know, in my morning meditation, I most often zoom out fully and I see myself and the world and the continent and then the earth and the immensity around. And it sounds cheesy, but it's just true, right? Like the stars, I try and feel the vastness of space, and I try and feel how everything around me has come to be and where it came from and how it got there, the food in my fridge, the clothes, like the sheets. I just sense in a sort of intellectual sometimes, but also physical way, the everything at once-ness, right? And the kind of million points of co-arising where life is just happening. But sometimes it's just so overwhelming, especially if we are caring about the beauty and we see the pain. And as you said, you cry once a day. I want to get into supportiveness for other people, because you found a way of coping with both the beauty and the pain. I found a way of coping with both the beauty and the pain. And one of the most common questions I think we get asked is, what can I do? Where do I start? There's two pieces of writing that you've done that I think are so exquisite that I really hope that everyone reads. But it's this idea of how we develop a wiser culture. And the first is this piece you wrote on Dharma inquiry. I'll get into it. And the second one is about how to live a meaningful life. In the Dharma Inquiry, this was where you wrote me a letter for my birthday a few years ago, and it was so beautiful. I won't share it out loud fully, but there was one piece, and you're speaking about the work that I was doing to bring people into the land and to connect people to the world. But you said, you know, I can't word people into the worldless. I can at best point in the direction, but they need to go there. And so you wrote this piece that I feel is your gift at how can I point people in a direction and how can they start going there? And it was this Dharma inquiry piece or Dharma inquiry. What led you to write that piece, and how is it intended to support people as they grapple with the very same things that you and I are talking about? Because we're not special. I think most humans have these questions in the background of their awareness. They might not just have many people to talk to about it.
Yeah, something that early on in how to address problems of the world was really upsetting for me was that a documentary like An Inconvenient Truth would come out. Everybody who watched it, or many of the people who watched it, would be moved. And then they'd ask, what can I do? But like this person is a solid state engineer, and this person's an accountant, and this person's a surgeon, and this person's a mother, and they live in different regions, and they all care about that because it affects everyone. But they also have different areas of passions. And how do you answer and broadcast to everybody? You do some very lowest common denominator thing and tell everyone to recycle and change their light bulbs. But that obviously doesn't compare to the nature of what's causing the problems in the world. And the answers aren't the same for everybody in terms of like what is theirs to do that's connected to also who they are, their being. And so I talked to thousands of people who were asking, what is mine to do? And I had to ask a lot of questions to get a sense of like, what are the things that you care most about and have the most passion about? And I would find that out by things like what problems when they see them upset them the most, and what people who are addressing something inspire them the most. And, you know, all those types of questions, because even though we might care about all of it, we're not going to work on everything simultaneously. The areas where the care is deepest is also where we can work the hardest.
Can I pause you there? You, Daniel, pointed out earlier in our conversation that we can't not care about everything because it's all connected. So how the hell do you choose a thing knowing that there's all of this other stuff that also matters? Sorry to interrupt you, but I think it's a really important question.
How I do is kind of unique to some dispositions I have that is not the same as how I would answer that everyone should. There are certain professions that I already think are doing about as good as someone with those skills could do for the world. So if I talk to someone who is a nurse or who is a kindergarten teacher, and they're in the profession rightly, it wasn't just what seemed like a good economic choice, but like they really want to care for the people. I don't want them to do anything different. The world would collapse without them doing the thing that they're doing. I want them, as they reflect on everything that is meaningful and sacred in the world, I want them to recognize these little children growing up, if they're a kindergarten teacher, are people who are going to do things that affect all of it. And in serving them, they serve all of it. I want them to bring their care in all the areas even more focusedly to be able to pour love into those people more intensely. And like there's a place where the fact that I don't get to do it all means my ego doesn't get to be the savior. And there is actually a trust of humanity and other people that is implicit, that's required. And so I think for most people, there is something like an acceptance that there are things that matter that you won't get to focus on directly. There's the same sense of sacredness underlying it all. It's all necessary. You get to take everything else you're aware of as fuel to be more deep and present, and then create relationships with people working on other areas you care about and see if you can be supportive of them in any way. For me, I did that, and I would just be working in this animal shelter with these animals. But thinking about all the animal shelters and thinking about all of the overfishing and all those things, I also happen to have a proclivity towards and the fortune to get some training on how to think about systems abstractly. And so I didn't not do those things, but I was also like, okay, the totality of well-intentioned people doing this is not sufficient. It's necessary. It's not sufficient because a lot of these things are moving in the wrong direction towards points of irreversibility. What's driving these things? Like, it doesn't seem like anyone wants climate change, but we can't stop it. It doesn't seem like anybody wants dead coral, but we can't stop it. It doesn't seem like anyone wants species extinction, but we can't stop it. It seems like the most significant features of our world nobody wants and we can't stop. And so how do we understand what is driving it? What are the whole set of system dispositions and what would it take to change that? That became a thing that I could focus on and is just another way of being able to address my care for all of those things.
That was your Dharma inquiry. Mm-hmm. That was a beautiful answer about how other people can hold the tension of caring about a lot more than maybe directly what they're working on and how to reconcile those pieces, because I know that is a struggle. And so you wrote this list of self-inquiry that people work through. I've used it and I've sent it to many people. But I feel it pairs really importantly with the one about living a meaningful life, because I think that our dharmas are unique, our life paths, our proclivities, our gifts, our neuroses, they're all unique. but there's some underlying pattern of living a meaningful life as a human being. And you made 3 points in that piece. The first one I think we've touched on, but maybe we should elaborate. It's appreciating the beauty of existence. The second one is adding to the beauty of existence, which we haven't directly spoken about. And then the third is increasing your ability to appreciate and add to the beauty of existence. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so those map to the modes of being, doing, and becoming.
Nice.
And the mode of being, if really clarified, what is it about, is not about me doing anything, but implicit in me being is sensing is still happening. I'm still part of the world in relationship with the world, and I can't not be taking the world in. Inner world and outer world, both. And there's something about like the beauty of a thing is partly in the relationship with something, appreciating it.
Meaning if there was no one to behold the beauty, what is that beauty itself?
It's not the same.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so the purpose of a reality is fulfilled partly in our appreciation of it. Like that could sound hubristic, and it's not like it needs me particularly, like all reality is experiencing itself, but it is in the inherently relational other than self experiencing self that is grounding the meaningfulness of it.
It's like that Bohm piece I just said, we're inquiring together into the beauty. Yes, it's relational.
And so like if someone is watching a sunset and they just feel grateful and awed, they're living a meaningful life in that moment. Because all of the doing that you could ever do to make the world better is so that people can have experiences like that. That's actually the ground of the whole thing. Why is doing worth anything if it doesn't ground in the experience of other beings? Not just humans, but all the sentient beings. Oh no, I need to do stuff and make the world better. Why? Make the world better so that the subjective experience of other sentient beings has more moments like that and less moments of abject suffering. Yeah. So if I'm not grounded in that myself, am I just actually trying to project my own emptiness into the world to heal it out there, as opposed to just how can I really improve the world? If improve it doesn't just mean some objective fact, but some subjective grounding of that objective fact mattering, if I don't understand subjectivity, I'll miss it, right? And the other thing is that's what makes me want to protect and serve the world. Like I want to protect a forest because I'm in love with the forest. Otherwise, if it's just an idea of that's the right thing to do, then it's still just like a wounded child psyche who's trying to like get it right in their parents' eyes. And this is their idea of what it is. And they're projecting the parent on the world or something like that. And that's just not that meaningful a motivation place. You don't do it because just like it's the right thing to do or whatever. You do it because there's something that you're doing. Like if that nurse is rightly motivated, she's seeing these people and she's like, they're lonely. They're scared. They're whatever. I feel them and I feel like I could be them. They feel an appreciation of this being. And then the desire to serve comes from that. And I think your desire to take CEOs out into the wilderness was like, if you see this, you won't want to cut it down. If you don't just see it, but like if you see it and take enough time here and feel it, you'll understand something that you couldn't understand by reading books about ecosystem services and how it sequesters CO2.
It's so entirely different. Can I just say, Daniel, and you know this about me, I continue to struggle with the feeling of not enoughness. I'm not doing enough. I'm not doing enough. I could do more. I could do more. What you said around like you just beholding the sunset, you just reveling in the world is meaningful in and of itself, is so profoundly important and liberating. And it's only been recently I feel that that's true. It's not even allowing myself. It's like I'm walking in the forest. I make a little shrine that no one will ever see apart from the forest itself. And I'm like, this is it. And it's that point, you know, one of the points in year three, adding to the beauty of existence. There's something inherently true about that and meaningful. And sometimes adding to the beauty of existence is just allowing yourself to see it.
And there's this paradox that if you let go of the mental pressure, I'm not doing enough, and you let yourself ground in appreciating reality more, a couple things happen. One is all the things that one is conditioned to think that they need in order to be happy or successful go away. Because they're not true. You don't need all those things to be like, I need X in order to be happy is an untrue statement for pretty much every X. And in the moment that someone is just playing in the waves or they're enraptured at the sunset or in listening to music or whatever, it's clear. Like there's a wholeness that is just because of connection to reality. So then what do I have to do to fulfill myself isn't the driving question anymore. And if that's still there, even while you're trying to do good because some part of you like believes you're supposed to, but there's a parts conflict, then the I'm trying to do good and I'm trying to fulfill myself and they're always together and it messes stuff up. And this is why then I need credit for the project. And this is why I need to control it. And this is why blah, blah, blah. As opposed to, I kind of can't imagine being more stoked than this. And I kind of can't imagine being luckier than this. What is left to want when what you want is being fulfilled is that other beings get to also have that. It's the only thing left to want. And so then from that place of kind of wholeness and fulfillment, a clearer service emerges that has less distortion in it and more energy and resource to work and then face really hard things and feel sourced in facing those hard things rather than just broken by them. And the last thing is then you see the forest and it's beautiful. Then you see clear cutting. And if you hadn't had an experience with how beautiful the forest is, you would not be as motivated. And now you're more motivated. So it's the depth of the experience that actually makes your work potent.
If this stuff that we're talking about is at the basis of so many of the polycrisis, metacrisis, risks, generator functions, if this stuff's at the base, what are the implications for how we do the things we do? How does it affect the work that you're doing? Don't you just want to start a school that just treats and, you know, educates every human being in this?
Totally. Don't I just want to spend my whole life doing like just taking care of dolphins, just taking care of coral, just taking care of dogs, just working with parents preconception to prepare themselves for parenting, just working with little kids and all of their curiosities. Like, yes, I am particularly afflicted by the romance of every life.
Yes, me too.
And the desire to live all of them. And this actually used to be one of my main sources of suffering as a kid, was that I wanted to meet all the people and learn all the languages and see all the places and serve all the things and study all the topics. And I would go to a library and just look at all the books and know I couldn't read them all and just cry and overwhelm.
A cute little kid in the library crying because he can't read all the books.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's actually something that a lot of people feel if they're allowed to spend some time feeling how important each of these things are, how transformative it could be, how meaningful it could be. And so what I realized was that that impulse to want to know all the things and be all the things and do all the things was life's impulse. And life is doing it through all the people and all the beings. And this body and mind doesn't get to do all those things, but this body and mind can do the best it can to be in service to life getting to do and be all those things through everyone. And so if someone else is working in one of the fields that I can imagine wanting to dedicate my whole life to, then I'm in service to them. Because the way that I can fulfill that impulse best is something I can do to serve them where they can keep putting all their life into it.
There's this inherent joy that comes out of seeing other people loving the things that you know you're not going to be able to do.
So much.
I've never really experienced this version of jealousy. I've experienced like, oh my God, it's so cool. You get to like be a backcountry snowboarder. I know I'll never do that, but like, I'm just like celebrating all of the versions of life that everyone gets to live and the other creatures too. You know, Life Worlds is about our relationship to other beings. And I think if you're able to inhabit less of your immediate self, you can start to feel what it's like to be those other beings doing those things just for a split second, even if it's your imagination. And then you don't need to grab onto it. You don't need to be or do it all because there is this complicity in a way that part of you is already doing it. It's just not the you that's like right here.
No, I think a lot of people have this experience that when someone is doing something that is obviously amazing, but not what they're trying to do, it's easy to appreciate it, right? Like you're a mathematician and you go to a concert and see an amazing musician and you're like, wow. It's harder for people to sometimes appreciate someone who's doing amazing work in the field that they're wanting to do work, because that's where their ego gets wrapped up, because they've identified that whatever credit that person is getting, whatever love and appreciation they're getting, whatever mastery they have, I'm supposed to be getting. Mm-hmm. And yet, if you've dedicated your life to an area for the right reason, that you actually love it and want to serve it, and someone else is doing amazing at serving that thing, you should be the most stoked. And if not, there's something to look at inside regarding where it's coming from. It's coming from some place of not wholeness, love, and service. It's coming from some other place. And that's fine. Like, that happens. But that's where your own psychological work matters.
Yeah.
And it's why the coming from the place of just a depth of connection, communion, love, and desire to serve it. If someone else is solving a problem that I was wanting to solve, then I get to be so stoked and be like, I didn't know if I could solve that. I didn't know. Like, I was failing in many ways at that. Like, I'm glad more people are working on it. And that's also just such an important thing.
I want to express that these conversations, even though they may seem philosophical and abstract, are so important in the work that we're all doing. And this conversation, in all the different versions that we've had over the years, have nourished me and held me and healed me. So thank you. Thank you for not just all the incredible, difficult technical work that you're doing, but for being one of the rare people who holds this way of being around the sacred as you do this work, because I am sure that it's transforming people as they come into contact with it. I wanted to ask about morality and ethics and the human kingdom versus the animal kingdoms. And there's a lot of things that we've talked about offline in this that I want to share with others, but we'll have another fireside chat for that. Is there anything that you feel compelled to share?
I love that you have made a place where humans in relationship to and service to the non-human living world is the whole focus, and that you're using your amazing poetry to be evocative of that for people and so many other people's perspectives on it. And this conversation gets to happen. Yeah. You are one of the beings that increases my hope for the world and humanity. And I love getting to be here with you too.
Oh, the fire is now super low. And the first fireside chat conversation is drawing to a close. Daniel, thank you. I will link to some of these beautiful pieces that you've written that people may not have yet come across. And keep writing your poetry. I need new pieces from you. God damn it.
I would love if someone works on the things I'm working on and like just handles them, and I'll go back to poetry.
Got to do it at the same time. That was the whole point of the conversation.
I know.
Thank you for your time. Thank you for this conversation.